Because of the way the universe is created, we each of us live in two worlds at the same time. And we have to adjust to both. And both adjustments are difficult. We have to adjust to a material life in which everything seems to be very solid and dense, and most things are rather solid and dense. We also have to live in a world where there are tremendous forces operating that we can't even see. We have to live in the outer life of our own bodies and the inner life of our own souls. And this combination results in a series of extraordinary circumstances that have distinguished human existence from the beginning of time. As a citizen of two worlds, man must try to adjust to both. And this adjustment is not easy. This adjustment is conflicting in its various elements. There are many things we can't understand. There are things about the outer life that do not correspond happily with the inner life. And the internal part of man is constantly locked away from his physical daily existence. But at certain periods of life and certain periods of history, these two worlds have more or less come together. And every year, in a large sense of the word, they meet at the winter solstice. They meet at a time when, for a little while, the inner has domination over the outer. For a little while, man's inner life becomes obvious to him. It is revealed in various ways. It is especially obvious to children who discover, for instance, that there is a way of life that they do not experience in the ordinary problems of growth and schooling. On certain sacred occasions, life becomes a release of affections, regards, and understandings that we are too busy to live with most of the time. So at certain seasons and at certain times in history, these breakthroughs have become terribly important. And at this time especially, anything that we can release from within is going to be important to our happiness and security. Now, this world of the inner is invisible in a sense, and yet there are things happening in it all the time that we are aware of. We do not understand the process of thought. We do not know how we think. And we know there is some divine dispensation behind the fact that we do think. The mental process is very obscure. And it is subject to all kinds of infirmities and all kinds of adulterations and excesses. And yet it springs up from within ourselves. Also, when we were 4 or 5 years old, we had a very serious illness and maybe came very close to death. We paid little attention to that after we reached 40 or 50 years of age, and then suddenly, someday, for no particular reason, the incident returns perfectly clear. It has been lurking somewhere in memory, and we were not even aware that he did remember until it was jogged into the foreground again by some circumstance. We discover that we have the power to think, to analyze, to examine, to record. We can compose great music. The body doesn't do it. We can also make great art, but the hands are not the artists. Something inside of us that is bigger than our body or our outer life is constantly influencing conduct. We can do all kinds of things to block this higher something. If we find it interferes with economic security, we are apt to deny it. Under certain circumstances, popular opinion gravitates against it, and we become ashamed of being enlightened beings. All these changes are taking place in something that is very real, and yet we can't see it. Also in sleep, we come across a number of interesting circumstances. We enter into a universe that has dimensions, proportions, in which incidents and circumstances occur, in which we are, for a time, immersed in a kind of phantom civilization or a phantom environment. And we can't but ask ourselves, are these dreams simply imaginings, or do they exist somewhere in the constitution of the individual as factors in his own intrinsic nature? It seems to me that with the study of the esoteric arts and sciences, we are forced to conclude that the invisible universe within us and around us is real, that it is not a phantom, that the various ideas that float through our minds are not just something like a cloud that will be dispersed by the first ray of sunshine. This inner life has a reality of its own. It is a reality that we sometimes retire into while we're still alive, in meditation, in prayer, in spiritual exaltation. It is also a place we hide in when pain and sorrow and misery afflict us. This inner invisible world has rules and laws, dimensions and proportions, just as much as the physical world. And we, in a way, have to live in both of them. We have to always recognize that in an emergency in the outer, we take refuge in the inner. And in a sense, if we have an emergency in the inner as a neurosis or a fixation of some kind, we seek escape into the outer. If the inner is sick, we can often help it by attacking it through materialistic achievements or accomplishments. We can go to school, we can paint pictures, we can write wonderful books and music. If that helps us to relieve some kind of internal pressure. So where one fails, it turns the job over to the other. And these two work together through the whole long period of life. In some way, many people are convinced that passing over from this world is simply a retirement into this inner life, which suddenly becomes the total habitation. We know also that the imaginations of childhood are sometimes really very consistent and very important. Most children, particularly in the first 4 or 5 years of life, have an extrasensory perception gamut. They see things we do not see. They also have experiences that we cannot explain. Sometime when you are visiting a family that has a newborn baby, is just beginning to open its eyes and see, look at its eyes when it looks at you. And you will almost always notice that it is looking over your head and not at you. Now, this is not because the muscles are so weak. It's because that child is aware of the magnetic field. It doesn't know what it is, and it's going to forget it ever saw it. But under regressions of one kind or another, the child might be caused to remember why it looked over your head and not at you. This is a common circumstance that most people have recorded in connection with small children. The child also lives in a world which has not yet been contaminated by material realities. It is not bound into the kind of tight package that is going to gradually control it as it gets older. It is still living in a world that is beautiful. It is in a world that political circumstances mean nothing to. It is a pristine creature. A creature that is largely still living in this invisible realm, in the sense that realities, while they're not diagnosed, not analyzed, not described, have a strange inner influence, and the child is looking out from within toward the outside. When it gets older, it must sometimes look from the outside inward to find the source of its own life and its own intelligence and its own security. Now, children have many fables, and grown-up people have fables. And I think we all have to realize that there is no nation, no culture, no civilization that has ever existed that has not had its age of fable. There are all kinds of stories and beliefs and traditions. There are all kinds of mysterious and wonderful legends. And they are now regarded largely as dreams of childhood or handed down from primitive times. But actually, most nations have built upon these fables their psychology of life. Nearly all of the great systems of culture that we know have been established upon folklore. And folklore is sometimes an amazingly accurate thing. Folklore is sometimes an unexplainable but real intervention or involvement of consciousness in some type of symbolism. So symbolism becomes very important in the life of the individual. And symbolism is nearly always the inside telling the outside something. With the physical eyes, we see the flower. With the inner eye of the spiritual rationality, we begin to think about the flower. We don't simply see it as something growing. We feel a mood about it. It becomes something that inclines us to a gracious acceptance. This flower makes us happy. It becomes a symbol of some value or virtues, based merely perhaps upon its shape, its color, or its fragrance. But the inner life estimates these things, while the pure and complete materialist just looks at it and says it's a flower. So the outside sees the form, but somewhere inside we sense a meaning. And this meaning is the basis of symbolism, and this symbolism is based upon man's consciousness and the impact of meaning upon the things around him. So man lives in a world of physical circumstances which are comparatively barren until inner meaning lights them, gives them a luminous quality, makes them important, and makes it possible for them to contribute to our well-being as we go along. Now, among all the legends we have about these things, I think we can compare two systems of legendary that seemingly have a peculiar vitality. One is Buddhism and the other is Christianity. These two are tremendous revelations that from the very beginning had a delicate balance between internal experience and external circumstances. In the Buddhist religion, as it is practiced in about 700 or 800 million homes, in Buddhism, the idea is that all visible things are suspended from invisible causes. And these invisible causes are so very close to us that at any moment they may break through into our visual consciousness. All of the great hierarchies of Buddhism are internal realities. These various supernatural, superphysical beings are not regarded as merely shadows, nor are they accepted as physical literalisms. They are not dated as historical personages. They live in this mysterious inner life of realities. They are powers, they are forces, they are principles. They are reactions to circumstance, and they are the refuge in time of trouble. For the individual, in pain or sorrow, seeks the consolation of realities, invisible but all-powerful. Now, the same is true in Christianity. The various doctrines and beliefs of Christianity are largely exhibitions or releases of inner realities. They are things that we think of as principles and then clothe them with forms. We give them a dimensional existence, although we realize that it is our own inner eye that sees this in the physical thing. We have an inner perception that looking at an ordinary object no longer sees it as ordinary, but sees it as some kind of a magnificent mystery. In the physical world, things are very profane and prosaic. But in the world of inner realities, everything is wonderful. Everything is miraculous. It is full of supernatural circumstances, because these are always there. But in our material, external life, we remove these supernatural experiences and simply accept words, names, titles, and things of this nature in our acceptance of things that happen to us. I think it's very nice to remember maybe a little word from Socrates on this particular point. And Socrates one day was talking to one of his disciples, and he put his hand into the stack of vegetables in a cart, and he pulled out a carrot. And he said to his disciple, "What is this?" "Why," he says, "it's a carrot." So Socrates said, "And what is a carrot?" "Why, a carrot's a vegetable." "Yes." "And what is a vegetable?" "Well, it's anything that looks like a carrot." Socrates said, "That's fine. Now my ignorance is complete." And this is the problem. In the outer world, we name everything and understand nothing. In the inner life, we do not need any names, because the life in things acts upon our internal faculties. And perhaps this has something to do with Christmas, very definitely, in the dear old image of Santa Claus. Is Santa Claus really a myth? Well, we know that the old St. Nicholas of Myra was a real old bishop. We also know that he became famous all over the world for nearly 1900 years as the leader of generosity. During his own lifetime, it is said that on several occasions he pawned the cups and candlesticks on the altar of his church in order to serve the poor. In any event, he was a nice old gentleman, and he always did his generosities secretly. And he became gradually the symbol of unnamed giving. A giving which was to represent a pure release from the internal, that we gave because we wanted to and because there was a certain fulfillment that we can't get any other way. We can please the outer life by depositing something in the bank towards our old age security, but we please most the inner life by giving away something, by bestowing happiness or security upon others. Now, it's very possible that the church made a mistake when it decided that St. Nicholas was going to be removed from the calendar of saints. They said they couldn't find him, that there was a question as to whether he ever existed or not. And that is very, very interesting. The mood of the hour seems to suggest that secret giving has gone out of style. We don't want to be responsible to fulfill the image of a myth. In fact, we don't want to particularly fulfill it if it happens to be a fact. So the lack of the true spirit of giving may have something to do with the elimination of the saint. We don't believe in the quality of St. Nicholas. We are not taking money out of our banks or pockets too often to serve some person without their even knowing what we're doing. So the secret giver, which was the St. Nicholas ideal, is sort of in conflict with modern procedures. But on the other hand, what about it? For 18, 19 centuries, man has believed in a certain kind of secret generosity. Now, this has to have an original, and the original is in himself, inside. Therefore, somewhere lurking in the inner reality of things is a mysterious reality called Santa Claus. He doesn't have a long beard, he doesn't wear a red jacket, but he is a principle in us. He is something that is more real than many of the external things with which we become associated. Therefore, when we have to let little children know that there's a question as to whether there is a Santa Claus or not, what we are really telling them is that we no longer believe in this visualization within ourselves. We do not believe in Santa Claus because Santa Claus is not working inside of us. But somewhere in every human being, there is a Santa Claus. It has to be. Because from the beginning, human beings have, in moments at least, served others in need. They have given help to those who are desolated. And they have brought laughter and smiles to little children. And they have become symbols of generosity, which perhaps the child will remember in later time. Now, it's a pity, of course, that this whole procedure has been heavily commercialized. We know that. On the other hand, the instinct to give, the instinct of the secret giver, the instinct of man sensing something which he wants to express and finds difficulty in rationalizing. Now, the secret giver, of course, of all things, is divinity itself. It is the deity that is at the source of existence that is the bestower. Everything that we have comes from the generosity or the spiritual integrity of a power beyond ourselves. Also, however, this power has a certain astronomical cycle associated with it. And that astronomical cycle, of course, includes the solstices and the equinoxes. The sun, being the symbol, outer symbol of the eternal giver, has been built into hundreds of myths and legends, all of which have the same essential meaning, that the sun is the source of the benevolence of life and is therefore a proper symbol of the invisible sun within the reality of our spiritual existence, which is the true source of our existence. So the sun in its vernal equinox and its summer solstice moves through the year, and at the winter solstice it is born again. And this winter solstice therefore represents, is physically, symbolically, the return of the sun to the northern hemisphere. Spiritually, factually, within ourselves, this particular experience, this rising annually of the sun, is twofold. First, it does react upon our inner life in the form of increasing vitality. Physically, the coming of the sun strengthens the body, but the coming of the spiritual sun enlightens the interior of the being. Therefore, our greatest good in terms of the strengthening of the inner reality is the fact that every year this reality is fortified internally and externally by the mystery of enlightenment. The visible enlightenment and spiritual enlightenment. Now, in all the ancient mystery rites and so forth, the body became the symbol of a temple. The body is a temple, it is a sacred place. Humanity is a temple. Creation is a temple. And as one writer said, that this universal temple has for its spans and arches the clasped hands of comrades. It is a great living thing, alive invisibly, and also gradually moving into visibility from the inner life of the individual. In the ancient metaphysics of the Kabbalah, it is said that the temple on Mount Moriah, the physical temple of Solomon the King, is on earth directly beneath the eternal and invisible temple of the eternal in the sky above. And the same is true with us. Our visible life is in the visible world, but it is a reflection or a suspension from that which is invisible and is the source of it. And at the time of Christmas, we like to think that perhaps this invisible reality comes and lives with us a little while. We like to believe that there are occasions in which the inner breaks through into the outer. And it does, almost any time. A simple example of the breaking through is our love for beauty and our love for growth and tenderness and kindness to living things. Whenever we have a great affection, something more than the body is involved. This affection is the recognition of love as a reality, not as an emotion. That love exists eternally as a kind of abstract being, and that this same being has a throne inside of our own realities. Therefore, that we love because love is. We are grateful because gratitude is. We are hopeful because hope is. And we serve each other because this is a way of testifying to the natural benevolence that is inside of us. So we are very complicated inside, and very often the inside becomes in conflict with the outside. Sometimes when the inside says, be generous, we don't listen, because it is contrary to the will of the outside. Now, the outside is represented in its highest aspect by the mind. The mind being in its own nature, the leader of the body. The mind is a kind of ego. It is a shadowy reflection of a power greater than itself. And that which is greater than itself and behind the mind is the soul. Therefore, the soul becomes embodied in the mind. But the mind never really understands it. The mind never really accepts the soul completely, because the soul says give and the mind says take. And this inconsistency follows us all the days of our years. Now, in the Christmas season, there seems to be a tendency of people to react naturally to something a little better than the normal consideration of things. Now, we know the mind has its own Christmas in the physical world. And this mind world is, therefore, the mind saying, I give because I have had something given to me. Or it says, the mind, well, I will gain satisfaction, I will be proud of myself because I have shared or given. Or it is a duty to give, my religion says so. Or it is nice to make the children happy. All these things are being worked out in the mind. And in very many cases, the mind is pretty generous. It does very well. And it seems to meet all the needs. But as the poem tells us, the gift without the giver is bare. Absolutely, the ensoulment of the gift is through the inner reality of the individual. It is when the individual inwardly experiences a strange kind of fulfillment in sharing, and there is a great happiness that is not tangible, that is not reflected in the financial value of a gift, but is part of an impulse that has been in us from the beginning of time. Always there are certain things that move us. Beauty moves us. Not because physically we understand it, but because something inside of us reacts to it. Great music is a physical thing, but in some way it touches the internal. And the arts form bridges between the material realities and the inner realities. And all through life, we are trying to balance these two. When we manage to accomplish a reasonable degree of adjustment on the outside, we can say to ourselves, we are comfortable. We are comfortable, we are secure, and we are in control of the situations that preserve our physical lives. But there is something else. The inner reality isn't satisfied with comfort. The inner reality wants to be happy. And happiness, as the Arabian Nights fable says, must be earned. Happiness is something that is superior to comfort, to convenience. It has nothing to do with extravagance. It has nothing to do with elaborate festivities. Happiness is something inside in which we have performed an action that the inner reality has inspired and which it approves. Therefore, happiness, to be real, has nothing to do with what we have, really. It has to do with what we are and what we are doing in the
sense of fulfilling the highest and most abstract convictions of our nature. In Christianity, we have the example of a great sense of internal fulfillment. Christ becomes the symbol of man's dedicated existence. St. Paul says, "The Christ in you, the hope of glory." Well, the Christ in you dwells in this mysterious internal reality. Christ in us is the reality inwardly. And of course, the conflict in the church has been expressed through the story of the fall of man, the fall of the consciousness from the inner reality to the outer existence. Everywhere, when the individual turns his inner life into the keeping of his outer life, there is a fall of some kind. There is a misuse. There is a temptation. There is something which is depriving the individual of the final, ultimate fulfillment of himself. Therefore, in the thinking of this type of occasion, as we are in at the moment, the problem is to, of course, put the emphasis upon the fulfillment of the inner life, letting the spirit within us lead the way into conduct and condition. Now, it's also true that in many European countries, many parts of the world, Christmas is not actually a ceremony of exchanging gifts. Gifts are exchanged on another day, a few days before Christmas. And Christmas itself becomes a completely religious festival. This probably is very close to the reality. And the way it is worked out is that if the gifts have been given earlier as physical realities, and we have beheld the happiness and comfort and pleasure and perhaps security we have helped to contribute, then we are no longer involved in giving and taking on the actual day of Christmas itself. We are involved only in the spiritual mystery of, we might say, spiritual generosity. We are only in the presence of that which says to give is a great reality, to take is a physical reality. To create this inner life, we have to give expression to what is called sometimes the higher self. Now, this higher self is a little difficult to cultivate because we don't have any boundaries to work with. The inner self is something that is always telling us to do it right, whereas the outer self is trying to get us to advance our own causes regardless of circumstances. But the actual mystery of the do it right factor is represented as a religious festival, not as an exchanging of gifts. The gifts were exchanged on an earlier day, in the same month, some maybe a week before. But the actual ceremony is the individual testifying to the presence of the eternal giver, the eternal power which has made possible everything that we are. Therefore, each of us, in a sense, if we understand it correctly, become workers in the Santa Claus factory. We are all helping to make the gifts that Santa Claus is going to bring to the little children. We are there helping in the world, helping a war-stricken world, helping a destitute world, helping a terrified world, and preparing what we can in the form of inner strength to that which needs. This, therefore, becomes a kind of spiritual communion. It is the great moment of man's recognition that he is a servant of a principle greater than himself. We are all servants in the house of the eternal. This coming upon us at Christmas is a very valuable experience. There is no other festival that we have that has quite the participation. Easter is more a complete statement of the victory of the internal over the external. But Christmas is the birth or recognition of the existence of an eternal that is to come to birth at the vernal equinox. So we have all the symbols that are involved in Christianity. And most of all, we have this realization that the Sermon on the Mount, or the messages which have been given to us by enlightened leaders over the ages, represent a way of life that we should all definitely be following. In the actual problem itself, it also happens, of course, that parental influence on the young is a kind of Santa Claus experience. We take care of them until they can take care of themselves. We become a foster father or mother to those who come to us in this life. We are therefore forever giving to them, and most parents do not question the giving. In the small child and its needs, the human being depends almost completely upon the incentives of internal reality, love, understanding, sympathy, determination to be a fulfilling parent. These things come from the inside. Later, when the child gets old enough to be difficult, leadership is transferred to the outer reality, and we try to discipline. But in the beginning, the discipline is simply to care, to do that which is necessary to make things better. Now, in the Christmas spirit, we must never forget that we have a right to have a happy Christmas ourselves. There is no reason why Christmas should all be directed in some other direction. Nor is it selfish for us to think of ourselves at Christmas if we are thinking on the level of reality. If we are thinking on the level of internal good, if the inside is given the chance to bring its fulfillment of happiness, then we are merely really releasing God through our own action and conduct. It is only selfish when it is on the objective realities, the physical. Physical realities, we want things. The invisible spiritual realities, we do not want things. We invest everything in the release of the divine through ourselves. It is deity we serve, not ourselves. So this Christmas, with the world in its rather complicated condition, I think we should try to make Christmas a little more meaningful in terms of release of the real through ourselves. One thing perhaps we have to do is revise our own thinking as to Christmas. To revise our feeling, for instance, that comes to the surface almost instantly, that it is simply the merchant's holiday. That we don't really want to give these things. We do not really want to spend our money on other people, but it's a moral duty because they've given things to us. This attitude is basically a physical attitude. It has to do with the things we get in the material world and the world in which we live materially and our relationships with other material beings in this world. But behind this is this other, more important thing. The process of realizing that material reality is largely dedicated to taking and spiritual reality to giving. There's great difference between these two. The giving of self, the giving of that which is reality inside. Now, it doesn't cost a nickel to do this. There is no problem of expense, but it is a far more difficult thing to do. It is not so bad to go down and buy something for a person, but it is much more difficult to bestow upon ourselves a higher dimension of our own integrity. It is hard for us to dedicate our soul life to the service of a spiritual reality. It is time to think very carefully of the type of gift reality in its spiritual sense bestows. In life, it bestows harmony. It helps to create peace. It gives us continuities of responsibility. It makes sincerity. And it makes an unselfish solution to many of the problems of outer living. But this all has to be fortified by internal reality, or it becomes too much of a burden, too difficult, and hardly worthwhile. It has to be founded on an internal realization. Now, in the internal realizations of things, where do our faults most frequently arise? I would say they most arise in judging, condemning, and analyzing, and conflicting, and competing. These are the things which have a tendency to disfigure the outer life and inhibit and frustrate the inner life. So we can take little things and give ourselves the greatest gift of all, and that is the gift of a released, manifesting internal reality. This reality can take up all kinds of problems. And of course, from a physical standpoint, this is regarded as inappropriate at the time. But it may be not fashionable at the moment, but it is fashionable for all eternity. And this is to straighten out, as far as we possibly can, all the ulterior attitudes with which we are not only deforming ourselves, but endangering ourselves. Reality, among other things, is health. Reality is the individual in whose nature there is no conflict. Sickness is very largely the karmic reaction of conflict. There are various causes, but this is one of the most important. Therefore, the proper recognition and practice of the inner realities lengthens life, makes it more pleasant, bestows beauty and affection upon others around us, and makes our own life glow with a certain internal radiance, which is contagious or infectious or whatever you want to call it. Other people take it on. They see these qualities and they respect them, even though they cannot actually practice themselves. So at Christmas season, let's give the lower reality, the personal reality, the benediction of an internal reality experience. Let us try to turn the destiny of our own composites over to the best part of ourselves, at least for a little while, and get used to the experience. Ultimately, we'll have it all the time. We have to. But at the moment, we'll be fortunate if we can keep it even for a few hours. But it can help. It can build towards the things we want to accomplish.